presented their strategy canvases at what we call a visual strategy fair. Attendees include senior corporate executives, but consisted mainly of representatives of EFS's external constituencies, the kinds of people the managers had met with during their field trips, including non-customers, customers of competitors, and some of the most demanding EFS customers. In 2 hours, the teams presented all 12 curves, 6 by the online group and 6 by the offline group. They were given no more than 10 minutes to present each curve on the theory that any idea that takes more than 10 minutes to communicate is probably too complicated to be any good. The pictures were hung on the walls so that the audience could easily see them. After the 12 strategies were presented, each judge, an invited attendee, was given 5 sticky notes and told to put them next to his or her favorites. The judges could put all 5 on a single strategy if they found it that compelling. The transparency and immediacy of this approach freed it from the politics that sometimes seem endemic to the strategic planning process. Managers had to rely on the originality and clarity of their curves and their pitches. One began, for example, with the line, "We've got a strategy so cunning that you won't be our customers, you'll be our fans." After the notes were posted, the judges were asked to explain their picks, adding another level of feedback to the strategy-making process. Judges were also asked to explain why they did not vote for the other value curves. As the teams synthesized the judges' common likes and dislikes, they realized that fully 1/3 of what they had thought were key competitive factors were, in fact, marginal to customers. Another 1/3 either were not well articulated or had been overlooked in the visual awakening phase. It was clear that the executives needed to reassess some long-held assumptions, such as EFS's separation of its online and traditional businesses. They also learned that buyers from all markets had a basic set of needs and expected similar services. If you met those common needs, customers would happily forego everything else. Regional differences became significant only when there was a problem with the basics. This was news to many people who had claimed that their regions were unique. Following the strategy fair, the teams were finally able to complete their mission. They were able to draw a value curve that was a truer likeness of the existing strategic profile than anything they had produced earlier, in part because the new picture ignored the specious distinction that EFS had made between its online and offline businesses. More important, the managers were now in a position to draw a future strategy that would be distinctive as well as speak to a true but hidden need in the marketplace. EFS's future strategy eliminated relationship management and reduced investment in account executives, who, from this point on, were assigned only to AAA accounts. These moves dramatically reduced EFS's costs because relationship managers and account executives were the highest cost element of its business. EFS's future strategy emphasized ease of use, security, accuracy, and speed. These factors would be delivered through computerization, which would allow customers to input data directly instead of having to send a fax to EFS. This action would also free up corporate dealers' time, a large portion of which had been spent completing paperwork and correcting errors. Dealers would now be able to provide richer market commentary, a key success factor. Using the Internet, EFS would send automatic confirmations to all customers, and it would offer a payment tracking service, just as FedEx and UPS do for parcels. The foreign exchange industry had never offered these services before. The new value curve exhibited the criteria of a successful strategy. It displayed more focus than the previous strategy. Investments that were made were given a much stronger commitment than before. It also stood apart from the industry's existing Me Too curves and lent itself to a compelling tagline. The FedEx of corporate foreign exchange. Easy, reliable, fast, and trackable. By collapsing its online and traditional businesses into one compelling offering, EFS substantially cut the operational complexity of its business model, making systematic execution far easier. Step 4. Visual communication. After the future strategy is set, the last step is to communicate it in a way that can be easily understood by any employee. EFS distributed the one-page picture showing its new and old strategic profiles so that every employee could see where the company stood and where it had to focus its efforts to create a compelling future. The senior managers who participated in developing the strategy held meetings with their direct reports to walk them through the picture, explaining what needed to be eliminated, reduced, raised, and created to pursue a blue ocean. Those people passed the message on to their direct reports. Employees were so motivated by the clear game plan that many pinned up a version of the picture in their cubicles as a reminder of EFS's new priorities and the gaps that needed to be closed. The new picture became a reference point for all investment decisions. Only those ideas that would help EFS move from the old to the new value curve were given the go-ahead. When, for example, regional offices requested that the IT department add links on the website, something that in the past would have been agreed to without debate, IT asked them to explain how the new links helped move EFS toward its new profile. If the regional offices couldn't provide an explanation, the request was denied, thereby promoting clarity and not confusion on the website. Similarly, when the IT department pitched a multi-million-dollar back-office system to top management, the system's ability to meet the new value curve's strategic needs was the chief metric by which it was judged. Visualizing strategy at the corporate level. Visualizing strategy can also greatly inform the dialogue among individual business units and the corporate center in transforming a company from a red ocean to a blue ocean player. When business units present their strategy canvases to one another, they deepen their understanding of the other businesses in the corporate portfolio. Moreover, the process also fosters the transfer of strategic best practices across units. Using the strategy canvas. To see how this works, consider how Samsung Electronics of Korea used strategy canvases at its 2000 corporate conference, which was attended by more than 70 top managers, including the CEO. Unit heads presented their canvases and implementation plans to senior executives and to one another. Discussions were heated, and a number of unit heads argued that the freedom of their units to form future strategies was constrained by the degree of competition they faced. Poor performers felt that they had little choice but to match their competitors' offerings. That hypothesis proved to be false when one of the fastest-growing units, the mobile phone business, presented its strategy canvas. Not only did the unit have a distinctive value curve, but it also faced the most intense competition. Samsung Electronics has institutionalized the use of the strategy canvas in its key business creation decisions by establishing the Value Innovation Program, VIP, Center in 1998. Core cross-functional team members of its various business units come together in the VIP Center to discuss their strategic projects. These discussions typically focus on strategy canvases. With the value innovation knowledge it has developed, the center, equipped with 20 project rooms, assists the units in making their product and service offering decisions. In 2003, the center completed more than 80 strategic projects and opened more than 10 VIP branches to meet business units' rising demands. For example, the world's leading 40-inch LCD TV, launched in December 2002, is the result of one project team's devoted 4-month efforts made at the center. So is the world's best-selling mobile phone, the SGH T100, which has sold more than 10 million units. Since 1999, Samsung Electronics has established an annual Value Innovation Corporate Conference presided over by all of its top executives. At this conference, Samsung's hit Value Innovation projects are shared through presentations and exhibitions, and awards are given to the best cases. This is one way that Samsung Electronics establishes a common language system, instilling a corporate culture and strategic norms that drive its corporate business portfolio from red to blue oceans. Do your business unit heads lack an understanding of the other businesses in your corporate portfolio? Are your strategic best practices poorly communicated across your business units? Are your low-performing units quick to blame their competitive situations for their results? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, try drawing and then sharing the strategy canvases of your business units. Using the Pioneer Migrator Settler, PMS, map. Visualizing strategy can also help managers responsible for corporate strategy predict and plan the company's future growth and profit. All the companies that created blue oceans in our study have been pioneers in their industries, not necessarily in developing new technologies, but in pushing the value they offer customers to new frontiers. Extending the pioneer metaphor can provide a useful way of talking about the growth potential of current and future businesses. A company's pioneers are the businesses that offer unprecedented value. These are your blue ocean strategists, and they are the most powerful sources of profitable growth. These businesses have a mass following of customers. Their value curve diverges from the competition on the strategy canvas. At the other extreme are settlers, businesses whose value curves conform to the basic shape of the industries. These are Me Too businesses. Settlers will not generally contribute much to a company's future growth. They are stuck within the red ocean. The potential of migrators lies somewhere in between. Such businesses extend the industry's curve by giving customers more for less, but they don't alter its basic shape. These businesses offer improved value, but not innovative value. These are businesses whose strategies fall on the margin between red oceans and blue oceans. A useful exercise for a corporate management team pursuing profitable growth is to plot the company's current and planned portfolios on a Pioneer Migrator Settler PMS map. For the purpose of the exercise, settlers are defined as Me Too businesses, migrators are business offerings better than most in the marketplace, and pioneers are the only ones with a mass following of customers. If both the current portfolio and the planned offerings consist mainly of settlers, the company has a low growth trajectory, is largely confined to red oceans, and needs to push for value innovation. Although the company might be profitable today, as its settlers are still making money, it may well have fallen into the trap of competitive benchmarking, imitation, and intense price competition. If current and planned offerings consist of a lot of migrators, reasonable growth can be expected. But the company is not exploiting its potential for growth, and it risks being marginalized by a company that value innovates. In our experience, the more an industry is populated by settlers, the greater is the opportunity to value innovate and create a blue ocean of new market space. This exercise is especially valuable for managers who want to see beyond today's performance. Revenue, profitability, market share, and customer satisfaction are all measures of a company's current position. Contrary to what conventional strategic thinking suggests, these measures cannot point the way to the future. Changes in the environment are too rapid. Today's market share is a reflection of how well a business has performed historically. Think of the strategic reversal and market share upset that occurred when CNN entered the U.S. news market. ABC, CBS, and NBC, all with historically strong market shares, were devastated. Chief executives should instead use value and innovation as the important parameters for managing their portfolio of businesses. They should use innovation because, without it, companies are stuck in the trap of competitive improvements. They should use value because innovative ideas will be profitable only if they are linked to what buyers are willing to pay for. Clearly, what senior executives should be doing is getting their organizations to shift the balance of their future portfolio toward pioneers. That is the path to profitable growth. The PMS map depicts this trajectory, showing the scatter plot of a company's portfolio of businesses, where the gravity of its current portfolio of 12 businesses, expressed as 12 dots, shifts from a preponderance of settlers to a stronger balance of migrators and pioneers. In pushing their businesses toward pioneers, however, senior executives should be well aware that even though settlers have marginal growth potential, they are frequently today's cash generators. On the other hand, pioneers have maximum growth potential, but often consume cash at the outset as they grow and expand. Evidently, senior managers' goal here should be to manage their portfolio of businesses to wisely balance between profitable growth and cash flow at a given point in time. Overcoming the limitations of strategic planning. Managers often express discontent, either explicitly or implicitly, with existing strategic planning, the core activity of strategy. To them, strategic planning should be more about collective wisdom building than top-down or bottom-up planning. They think that it should be more conversational than solely documentation-driven, and it should be more about building the big picture than about number-crunching exercises. It should have a creative component instead of being strictly analysis-driven, and it should be more motivational, invoking willing commitment, than bargaining-driven, producing negotiated commitment. Despite this appetite for change, however, scant work exists on building a viable alternative to existing strategic planning, which is the most essential management task in the sense that almost every company in the world not only does it, but often takes several grueling months each year to complete the exercise. Building the process around a picture addresses many of managers' discontents with existing strategic planning and yields much better results. As Aristotle pointed out, the soul never thinks without an image. Drawing a strategy canvas and a PMS map is not, of course, the only part of the strategic planning process. At some stage, numbers and documents must be compiled and discussed. But we believe that the details will fall into place more easily if managers start with the big picture of how to break away from the competition. The methods of visualizing strategy proposed here will put strategy back into strategic planning, and they will greatly improve your chances of creating a blue ocean. How do you maximize the size of the blue ocean you are creating? The following chapter addresses that precise question. Chapter 5. Reach Beyond Existing Demand. No company wants to venture beyond red oceans only to find itself in a puddle. The question is, how do you maximize the size of the blue ocean you are creating? This brings us to the third principle of Blue Ocean Strategy. Reach beyond existing demand. This is a key component of achieving value innovation. By aggregating the greatest demand for a new offering, this approach attenuates the scale risk associated with creating a new market. To achieve this, companies should challenge two conventional strategy practices. One is the focus on existing customers. The other is the drive for finer segmentation to accommodate buyer differences. Typically, to grow their share of a market, companies strive to retain and expand existing customers. This often leads to finer segmentation and greater tailoring of offerings to better meet customer preferences. The more intense the competition is, the greater, on average, is the resulting customization of offerings. As companies compete to embrace customer preferences through finer segmentation, they often risk creating too small target markets. To maximize the size of their blue oceans, companies need to take a reverse course. Instead of concentrating on customers, they need to look to non-customers. And instead of focusing on customer differences, they need to build on powerful commonalities in what buyers value. That allows companies to reach beyond existing demand to unlock a new mass of customers that did not exist before. Think of Callaway Golf. It aggregated new demand for its offering by looking to non-customers. While the U.S. golf industry fought to win a greater share of existing customers, Callaway created a blue ocean of new demand by asking why sports enthusiasts and people in the country club set had not taken up golf as a sport. By looking to why people shied away from golf, it found one key commonality uniting the mass of non-customers. Hitting the golf ball was perceived as too difficult. The small size of the golf club head demanded enormous hand-eye coordination, took time to master, and required concentration. As a result, fun was sapped for novices, and it took too long to get good at the sport. This understanding gave Callaway insight into how to aggregate new demand for its offering. The answer was Big Bertha, a golf club with a large head that made it far easier to hit the golf ball. Big Bertha not only converted non-customers of the industry into customers, but it also pleased existing golf customers, making it a runaway bestseller across the board. With the exception of pros, it turned out that the mass of existing customers also had been frustrated with the difficulty of advancing their game by mastering the skills needed to hit the ball consistently. The club's large head also lessened this difficulty. Interestingly, however, existing customers, unlike non-customers, had implicitly accepted the difficulty of the game. Although the mass of existing customers didn't like it, they had taken for granted that that was the way the game was played. Instead of registering their dissatisfaction with golf club makers, they themselves accepted the responsibility to improve. By looking to non-customers and focusing on their key commonalities, not differences, Callaway saw how to aggregate new demand and offer the mass of customers and non-customers a leap in value. Where is your locus of attention? On capturing a greater share of existing customers or on converting non-customers of the industry into new demand? Do you seek out key commonalities in what buyers value? Or do you strive to embrace customer differences through finer customization and segmentation? To reach beyond existing demand, think non-customers before customers, commonalities before differences, and desegmentation before pursuing finer segmentation. The three tiers of non-customers. Although the universe of non-customers typically offers big blue ocean opportunities, few companies have keen insight into who non-customers are and how to unlock them. To convert this huge latent demand into real demand in the form of thriving new customers, companies need to deepen their understanding of the universe of non-customers. There are three tiers of non-customers that can be transformed into customers. They differ in their relative distance from your market. The first tier of non-customers is closest to your market. They sit on the edge of the market. They are buyers who minimally purchase an industry's offering out of necessity, but are mentally non-customers of the industry. They are waiting to jump ship and leave the industry as soon as the opportunity presents itself. However, if offered a leap in value, not only would they stay, but also their frequency of purchases would multiply, unlocking enormous latent demand. The second tier of non-customers is people who refuse to use your industry's offerings. These are buyers who have seen your industry's offerings as an option to fulfill their needs, but have voted against them. In the Callaway case, for example, these were sports enthusiasts, especially the country club tennis set, who could have chosen golf but had consciously chosen against it. The third tier of non-customers is farthest from your market. They are non-customers who have never thought of your market's offerings as an option. By focusing on key commonalities across these non-customers and existing customers, companies can understand how to pull them into their new market. Let's look at each of the three tiers of non-customers to understand how you can attract them and expand your blue ocean. First tier non-customers. These soon-to-be non-customers are those who minimally use the current market offerings to get by as they search for something better. Upon finding any better alternative, they will eagerly jump ship. In this sense, they sit on the edge of the market. A market becomes stagnant and develops a growth problem as the number of soon-to-be non-customers increases. Yet locked within these first-tier non-customers is an ocean of untapped demand waiting to be released. Consider how Pret-a-Manger, a British fast food chain that opened in 1988, has expanded its blue ocean by tapping into the huge latent demand of first-tier non-customers. Before Pret, professionals in European city centers principally frequented restaurants for lunch. Sit-down restaurants offered a nice meal and setting. However, the number of first-tier non-customers was high and rising. Growing concerns over the need for healthy eating gave people second thoughts about eating out in restaurants. And professionals did not always have time for a sit-down meal. Some restaurants were also too expensive for lunch on a daily basis. So professionals were increasingly grabbing something on the run, bringing a brown bag from home, or even skipping lunch. These first-tier non-customers were in search of better solutions. Although there were numerous differences across them, they shared three key commonalities. They wanted lunch fast, they wanted it fresh and healthy, and they wanted it at a reasonable price. The insight gained from the commonalities across these first-tier non-customers shed light on how Pret could unlock and aggregate untapped demand. The Pret formula is simple. It offers restaurant-quality sandwiches made fresh every day from only the finest ingredients, and it makes the food available at a speed that is faster than that of restaurants and even fast food. It also delivers this in a sleek setting at reasonable prices. Consider what Pret is like. Walking into a pret-a-manger is like walking into a bright Art Deco studio. Along the walls are clean refrigerated shelves stocked with more than 30 types of sandwiches, average price $4 to $6, made fresh that day in that shop from fresh ingredients delivered earlier that morning. People can also choose from other freshly made items, such as salads, yogurt, parfaits, blended juices, and sushi. Each store has its own kitchen, and non-fresh items are made by high-quality producers. Even in its New York stores, Pret's baguettes are from Paris, its croissants are from Belgium, and its Danish pastries are from Denmark. And nothing is kept over to the next day. Leftover food is given to homeless shelters. In addition to offering fresh healthy sandwiches and other fresh food items, Pret speeds up the customer ordering experience from fast food's queue, order, pay, wait, receive, sit down purchasing cycle to a much faster browse, pick up, pay, leave cycle. On average, customers spend just 90 seconds from the time they get in line to the time they leave the shop. This is made possible because Pret produces ready-made sandwiches and other things at high volume with a high standardization of assembly, does not make to order, and does not serve its customers. They serve themselves, as in a supermarket. Whereas sit-down restaurants have seen stagnant demand, Pret has been converting the mass of soon-to-be non-customers into core, thriving customers who eat at Pret more often than they used to eat at restaurants. Beyond this, as with Callaway, restaurant-goers who were content to eat lunch at restaurants also have been flocking to Pret. Although restaurant lunches had been acceptable, the three key commonalities of first-tier non-customers struck a chord with these people. But unlike soon-to-be non-customers, they had not thought to question their lunch habits. The lesson? Non-customers tend to offer far more insight into how to unlock and grow a blue ocean than do relatively content existing customers. Today, Pret-a-Manger sells more than 25 million sandwiches a year from its 130 stores in the UK, and it recently opened stores in New York and Hong Kong. In 2002, it had sales of more than £1 million, $160 million. Its growth potential triggered McDonald's to buy a 33% share of the company. What are the key reasons first-tier non-customers want to jump ship and leave your industry? Look for the commonalities across their responses. Focus on these and not on the differences between them. You will glean insight into how to desegment buyers and unleash an ocean of latent untapped demand. Second-tier non-customers. These are refusing non-customers, people who either do not use or cannot afford to use the current market offerings because they find the offerings unacceptable or beyond their means. Their needs are either dealt with by other means or ignored. Harboring within refusing non-customers, however, is an ocean of untapped demand waiting to be released. Consider how J.C. Dassault, a vendor of French outdoor advertising space, pulled the mass of refusing non-customers into its market. Before J.C. Dassault created a new concept in outdoor advertising called street furniture in 1964, the outdoor advertising industry included billboards and transport advertisement. Billboards typically were located on city outskirts and along roads where traffic quickly passed by. Transport advertisement comprised panels on buses and taxis, which again people caught sight of only as they whizzed by. Outdoor advertising was not a popular campaign medium for many companies because it was viewed only in a transitory way. Outdoor ads were exposed to people for a very short time while they were in transit, and the rate of repeat visits was low. Especially for lesser-known companies, such advertising media were ineffective because they could not carry the comprehensive messages needed to introduce new names and products. Hence, many such companies refused to use such low-value-added outdoor advertising because it was either unacceptable or a luxury they could not afford. Having thought through the key commonalities that cut across refusing non-customers of the industry, J.C. Dassault realized that the lack of stationary downtown locations was the key reason the industry remained unpopular and small. In searching for a solution, J.C. Dassault found that municipalities could offer stationary downtown locations, such as bus stops, where people tended to wait a few minutes and hence had time to read and be influenced by advertisements. J.C. Dassault reasoned that if it could secure these locations to use for outdoor advertising, it could convert second-tier non-customers into customers. This gave it the idea to provide street furniture, including maintenance and upkeep, free to municipalities. J.C. Dassault figured that as long as the revenues generated from selling and space exceeded the costs of providing and maintaining the furniture at an attractive profit margin, the company would be on a trajectory of strong, profitable growth. Accordingly, street furniture was created that would integrate advertising panels. In this way, J.C. Dassault created a breakthrough in value for second-tier non-customers, the municipalities, and itself. The strategy eliminated cities' traditional costs associated with urban furniture. In return for free products and services, J.C. Dassault gained the exclusive right to display advertisements on the street furniture located in downtown areas. By making ads available in city centers, the company significantly increased the average exposure time, improving the recall capabilities of this advertising medium. The increase in exposure time also permitted richer contents and more complex messages. Moreover, as the maintainer of the urban furniture, J.C. Dassault could help advertisers roll out their campaigns in 2 to 3 days, as opposed to 15 days of rollout time for traditional billboard campaigns. In response to J.C. Dassault's exceptional value offering, the mass of refusing non-customers flocked to the industry. As a medium of advertisement, street furniture became the highest growth market in the overall display advertising industry. Global spending on street furniture between 1995 and 2000, for example, grew by 60%, compared with a 20% total increase in overall display advertising. By signing contracts of 8 to 25 years with municipalities, J.C. Dassault gained long-term exclusive rights for displaying ads with street furniture. After an initial capital investment, the only expenditure for J.C. Dassault in the subsequent years was the maintenance and renewal of the furniture. The operating margin of street furniture was as high as 40%, compared with 14% for billboards and 18% for transport advertisements. The exclusive contracts and high operating margins created a steady source of long-term revenue and profits. With this business model, J.C. Dassault was able to capture a leap in value for itself in return for a leap in value created for its buyers. Today, J.C. Dassault is the number one street furniture-based ad space provider worldwide, with 283,000 panels in 33 countries. What's more, by looking to second-tier non-customers and focusing on the key commonalities that turned them away from the industry, J.C. Dassault also increased the demand for outdoor advertising by existing customers of the industry. Until then, existing customers had focused on what billboard locations or bus lines they could secure, for what period and for how much. They took for granted that those were the only options available and worked within them. Again, it took non-customers to shed insight into the implicit assumptions of the industry and its existing customers that could be challenged and rewritten to create a leap in value for all. What are the key reasons second-tier non-customers refuse to use the products or services of your industry? Look for the commonalities across their responses. Focus on these and not on their differences. You will glean insight into how to unleash an ocean of latent, untapped demand. Third-tier non-customers. The third tier of non-customers is farthest away from an industry's existing customers. Typically, these unexplored non-customers have not been targeted or thought of as potential customers by any player in the industry. That's because their needs and the business opportunities associated with them have somehow always been assumed to belong to other markets. It would drive many companies crazy to know how many third-tier non-customers they are forfeiting. Just think of the long-held assumption that tooth whitening was a service provided exclusively by dentists and not by oral care consumer product companies. Consequently, oral care companies until recently never looked at the needs of these non-customers. When they did, they found an ocean of latent demand waiting to be tapped. They also found that they had the capability to deliver safe, high-quality, low-cost tooth whitening solutions, and the market exploded. This potential applies to most industries. Consider the U.S. defense aerospace industry. It has been argued that the inability to control aircraft costs is a key vulnerability in the long-term military strength of the United States. Soaring costs, combined with shrinking budgets, concluded a 1993 Pentagon report, left the military without a viable plan to replace its aging fleet of fighter aircraft. If the military couldn't find a way to build aircraft differently, military leaders worried, the United States would not have enough airplanes to properly defend its interests. Traditionally, the Navy, Marines, and Air Force differed in their conceptions of the ideal fighter plane, and hence each branch designed and built its own aircraft independently. The Navy argued for a durable aircraft that would survive the stress of landing on carrier decks. The Marines wanted an expeditionary aircraft capable of short takeoffs and landings. The Air Force wanted the fastest and most sophisticated aircraft. Historically, these differences among the independent branches were taken for granted, and the defense aerospace industry was regarded as having three distinct and separate segments. The Joint Strike Fighter, JSF, program challenged this industry practice. It looked to all three segments as potentially unexplored non-customers that would be aggregated into a new market of higher-performing, lower-cost fighter planes. Rather than accepting the existing segmentation and develop products according to the differences in specifications and features demanded by each branch of the military, the JSF program questioned these differences. It searched for the key commonalities across the three branches that had previously disregarded one another. This process revealed that the two highest-cost components of the three branches' aircraft were the same: avionics, software, and engines. The shared use and production of these components held the promise of enormous cost reductions. Moreover, even though each branch had a long list of highly customized requirements, most aircraft across branches performed the same missions. The JSF team looked to understand how many of these highly customized features decisively influenced the branch's purchase decision. Interestingly, the Navy's answer did not hinge on a wide range of factors. Instead, it boiled down to only two: durability and maintainability. With aircraft stationed on aircraft carriers thousands of miles away from the nearest maintenance hangar, the Navy wants a fighter that is easy to maintain and yet durable as a Mack truck, so that it can absorb the shock of carrier landings and constant exposure to salt air. Fearing that these two essential qualities would be compromised with the requirements of the Marines and the Air Force, the Navy bought its aircraft separately. The Marines had many differences in requirements from those of the other branches, but again, only two kept them from decisively avoiding joint aircraft purchases: the need for short takeoff, vertical landing, STOVL, and robust countermeasures. To support troops in remote and hostile conditions, the Marines need an aircraft that performs as a jet fighter and yet hovers like a helicopter. And given the low-altitude, expeditionary nature of their missions, the Marines want an aircraft equipped with various countermeasures, flares, electronic jamming devices, to evade enemy ground-to-air missiles because their planes are relatively easier targets given their short air-to-ground range. Tasked with maintaining global air superiority, the Air Force demands the fastest aircraft and superior tactical agility, the ability to outmaneuver all current and future enemy aircraft, and one equipped with stealth technology, radar-absorbing materials and structures to make it less visible to radar, and therefore more likely to evade enemy missiles and aircraft. The other two branches' aircraft lacked these factors, and hence the Air Force had not considered them. These findings on unexplored non-customers made the JSF a feasible project. The aim was to build one aircraft for all three divisions by combining those key factors while reducing or eliminating everything else. That is, all the factors that had been taken for granted by each branch but provided little value, or factors that had been overdesigned in the race to beat the competition. Some 20 competing factors in the Marine, Navy, and Air Force segments were eliminated or reduced. By combining the factors in this way and reducing or eliminating the rest, the JSF program is able to build one aircraft for all three branches. The result is a dramatic drop in costs, and hence the price per aircraft, with a leap in value and performance for all three branches. Specifically, the JSF promised to reduce costs to $33 million per aircraft from the current $190 million. At the same time, the performance of the JSF, now called the F-35, promised to be superior to that of any of the top-performing aircraft for the three branches, the Air Force's F-22, the Marines' AV-8B Harrier jet, and the Navy's F-18. The strategy canvas shows that while the JSF roughly maintains the distinctive strength of the Air Force's aircraft, agility and stealth, it also offers greater maintainability, durability, countermeasures, and STOVL, the key strengths required by the Navy and the Marines. These factors are powerful additions that the Air Force had assumed it could not have. By focusing on these key decisive factors and dropping or reducing all other factors in the three dominant domains of customization, namely design, weapons, and mission customization, the JSF program was able to offer a superior fighter plane at a lower cost. By reaching beyond the existing customers of each of the three military branches, the JSF aggregated demand previously divided among them. In fall 2001, Lockheed Martin was awarded the massive $200 billion JSF contract, the largest military contract in history, over Boeing. The first JSF F-35 is set to be delivered in 2010. To date, the Pentagon is confident that the program will be an unqualified success, not only because the strategic profile of the JSF F-35 achieves exceptional value, but also, equally important, because it has won the support of all three defense branches. Go for the biggest catchment. There is no hard and fast rule to suggest which tier of non-customers you should focus on and when, because the scale of blue ocean opportunities that a specific tier of non-customers can unlock varies across time and industries, you should focus on the tier that represents the biggest catchment at the time. But you should also explore whether there are overlapping commonalities across all three tiers of non-customers. In that way, you can expand the scope of latent demand you can unleash. When that is the case, you should not focus on a specific tier, but instead should look across tiers. The rule here is to go for the largest catchment. The natural strategic orientation of many companies is toward retaining existing customers and seeking further segmentation opportunities. This is especially true in the face of competitive pressure. Although this might be a good way to gain a focused competitive advantage and increase share of the existing market space, it is not likely to produce a blue ocean that expands the market and creates new demand. The point here is not to argue that it's wrong to focus on existing customers or segmentation, but rather to challenge these existing taken-for-granted strategic orientations. What we suggest is that to maximize the scale of your blue ocean, you should first reach beyond existing demand to non-customers and desegmentation opportunities as you formulate future strategies. If no such opportunities can be found, you can then move on to further exploit differences among existing customers. But in making such a strategic move, you should be aware that you might end up landing in a smaller space. You should also be aware that when your competitors succeed in attracting the mass of non-customers with a value innovation move, many of your existing customers may be attracted away because they too may be willing to put their differences aside to gain the offered leap in value. It is not enough to maximize the size of the blue ocean you are creating. You must profit from it to create a sustainable win-win outcome. The next chapter shows how to build a viable business model that produces and maintains profitable growth for your blue ocean offering. Chapter 6. Get the strategic sequence right. You've looked across paths to discover possible blue oceans. You've constructed a strategy canvas that clearly articulates your future blue ocean strategy. And you have explored how to aggregate the largest possible mass of buyers for your idea. The next challenge is to build a robust business model to ensure that you make a healthy profit on your blue ocean idea. This brings us to the fourth principle of blue ocean strategy. Get the strategic sequence right. This chapter discusses the strategic sequences of fleshing out and validating blue ocean ideas to ensure their commercial viability, With an understanding of the right strategic sequence and of how to assess blue ocean ideas along the key criteria in that sequence, you dramatically reduce business model risk. The right strategic sequence. Companies need to build their blue ocean strategy in the sequence of buyer utility, price, cost, and adoption. The starting point is buyer utility. Does your offering unlock exceptional utility? Is there a compelling reason for the mass of people to buy it? Absent this, there is no blue ocean potential to begin with. Here there are only two options: park the idea or rethink it until you reach an affirmative answer. When you clear the exceptional utility bar, you advance to the second step, setting the right strategic price. Remember, a company does not want to rely solely on price to create demand. The key question here is this: is your offering priced to attract the mass of target buyers so that they have a compelling ability to pay for your offering? If it is not, they cannot buy it, nor will the offering create irresistible market buzz. These first two steps address the revenue side of a company's business model. They ensure that you create a leap in net buyer value, where net buyer value equals the utility buyers receive minus the price they pay for it. Securing the profit side brings us to the third element, cost. Can you produce your offering at the target cost and still earn a healthy profit margin? Can you profit at the strategic price, the price easily accessible to the mass of target buyers? You should not let costs drive prices, nor should you scale down utility because high costs block your ability to profit at the strategic price. When the target cost cannot be met, you must either forego the idea because the blue ocean won't be profitable, or you must innovate your business model to hit the target cost. The cost side of a company's business model ensures that it creates a leap in value for itself in the form of profit, that is, the price of the offering minus the cost of production. It is the combination of exceptional utility, strategic pricing, and target costing that allows companies to achieve value innovation, a leap in value for both buyers and companies. The last step is to address adoption hurdles. What are the adoption hurdles in rolling out your idea? Have you addressed these up front? The formulation of Blue Ocean strategy is complete only when you can address adoption hurdles in the beginning to ensure the successful actualization of your idea. Adoption hurdles include, for example, potential resistance to the idea by retailers or partners. Because Blue Ocean strategies represent a significant departure from Red Oceans, it is key to address adoption hurdles up front. How can you assess whether your Blue Ocean strategy is passing through each of the four sequential steps? And how can you refine your idea to pass each bar? Let's address these questions, starting with utility. Testing for exceptional utility. The need to assess the buyer utility of your offering may seem self-evident, yet many companies fail to deliver exceptional value because they are obsessed by the novelty of their product or service, especially if new technology plays a part in it. Consider Philips's CDI, an engineering marvel that failed to offer people a compelling reason to buy it. The player was promoted as the imagination machine because of its diverse functions. CDI was a video machine, music system, game player, and teaching tool all wrapped into one. Yet it did so many different tasks that people could not understand how to use it. In addition, it lacked attractive software titles. So even though the CDI theoretically could do almost anything, in reality, it could do very little. Customers lacked a compelling reason to use it, and sales never took off. Managers responsible for Philips's CDI, as well as Motorola's Iridium, fell into the same trap. They reveled in the bells and whistles of their new technology. They acted on the assumption that bleeding-edge technology is equivalent to bleeding-edge utility for buyers, something that our research found is rarely the case. The technology trap that snagged Philips and Motorola trips up the best and brightest companies time and again. Unless the technology makes buyers' lives dramatically simpler, more convenient, more productive, less risky, or more fun and fashionable, it will not attract the masses, no matter how many awards it wins. Think, for example, of Starbucks, Cirque du Soleil, the Home Depot, Southwest Airlines, Yellowtail, or Ralph Lauren. Value innovation is not the same as technology innovation. To get around this trap, the starting point, as articulated in Chapter 2, is to create a strategic profile that passes the initial litmus test of being focused, being divergent, and having a compelling tagline that speaks to buyers. Having done this, companies are ready to expressly assess where and how the new product or service will change the lives of its buyers. Such a difference in perspective is important because it means that the way a product or service is developed becomes less a function of its technical possibilities and more a function of its utility to buyers. The buyer utility map helps managers look at this issue from the right perspective. It outlines all the levers companies can pull to deliver exceptional utility to buyers, as well as the various experiences buyers can have with a product or service. This map allows managers to identify the full range of utility spaces that a product or service can potentially fill. Let's look at the map's dimensions in detail. The six stages of the buyer experience cycle. A buyer's experience can usually be broken into a cycle of six stages, running more or less sequentially from purchase to disposal. Each stage encompasses a wide variety of specific experiences. Purchasing, for example, may include the experience of browsing eBay as well as the aisles of the Home Depot. At each stage, managers can ask a set of questions to gauge the quality of buyer's experience. The six utility levers. Cutting across the stages of the buyer's experience are what we call utility levers, the ways in which companies can unlock exceptional utility for buyers. Most of the levers are obvious. Simplicity, fun and image, and environmental friendliness need little explanation. Nor does the idea that a product might reduce a customer's financial, physical, or credibility risks. And a product or service offers convenience simply by being easy to obtain, use, or dispose of. The most commonly used lever is that of customer productivity, in which an offering helps a customer do things faster or better. To test for exceptional utility, companies should check whether their offering has removed the greatest blocks to utility across the entire buyer experience cycle for customers and non-customers. The greatest blocks to utility often represent the greatest and most pressing opportunities to unlock exceptional value. By locating your proposed offering on the 36 spaces of the buyer utility map, you can clearly see how and whether the new idea not only creates a different utility proposition from existing offerings, but also removes the biggest blocks to utility that stand in the way of converting non-customers into customers. If your offering falls on the same space or spaces as those of other players, chances are it is not a blue ocean offering. Consider the Ford Model T. Before its debut, the more than 500 automakers in the United States focused on building custom-made luxury autos for the wealthy. In terms of the buyer utility map, the entire industry focused on image in the use phase, creating luxury cars for fashionable weekend outings. Only one of the 36 utility spaces was occupied. The greatest blocks to utility for the mass of people, however, were not in refining the auto's luxury or stylish image. Rather, they had to do with two other factors. One was convenience in the use phase. The bumpy and muddy dirt roads that prevailed at the century's start were natural for horses to tread over, but often prevented finely crafted autos from passing. This significantly limited where and when cars could travel. Driving on rainy and snowy days was ill-advised, making the use of the car limited and inconvenient. The second block to utility was risk in the maintenance phase. The cars, being finely crafted and having multiple options, often broke down, requiring experts to fix them, and experts were expensive and in short supply. In one fell swoop, Ford's Model T eliminated these two utility blocks. The Model T was called the car for the great multitude. It came in only one color, black, and one model with scant options. In this way, Ford eliminated investments in image in the use phase. Instead of creating cars for weekends in the countryside, a luxury few could justify, Ford's Model T was made for everyday use. It was reliable, it was durable, it was designed to travel effortlessly over dirt roads and in rain, sleet, or shine. It was easy to fix and use. People could learn to drive it in one day. In this way, the buyer utility map highlights the differences between ideas that genuinely create new and exceptional utility and those that are essentially revisions of existing offerings or technological breakthroughs not linked to value. The aim is to check whether your offering passes the exceptional utility test, as did the Model T. By applying this diagnostic, you can find out how your idea needs to be refined.